as you maybe.
I think well, it depends on where she's filming, which is better for.
Ah,
her.
Okay. Dove filmi? Maybe you can
okay.
If you
sure, absolutely. Sure. Okay.
So we can, I think we can start. Actually, we have already started our seminar. We have talked quite a lot with some of you also. So once again, I apologize for my very bad English. I'm sorry for that. But on the other hand, I'm very happy, very glad to have here today Lee Edelman for the first time in Italy. As a guest of the Research Center Qualitas. Lee Edelman is Fletcher Professor of English Literature at the University of Tufts, Massachusetts. He's an expert in literature, cultural studies, cinema studies, philosophy, and psychoanalytic thought. He's one of the leading voices of queer theories in the United States and all over the world. Finally, Professor Edelman is one of the directors of the book collection Theory Q, for the prestigious Duke University Press. He's discussing his essay, No Future, Queer Theory and the Death Drive, published in 2004, has raised an intense international debate on the so-called antisocial thesis in queer theory. For his insistence on the structural connection between queerness, or as he says, symptomosexuality, and the death drive. His last work, Sex or the Unbearable, published this year, is not properly an essay, but a conversation with Lauren Berland on the concepts of optimism, cruel optimism, and negativity. He is now working on a new project, which will soon, at least I hope soon, become a book, and which will take its title from a famous movie by Pedro Almodovar, Bad Education. His conference of today is entitled Queer Negativity, Antisociality, Jewish Sounds, and the Death Drive. And I suppose this talk will give us some previews on the concept of bad education, which I'm very curious to listen. So please, Lee, I give you the floor.
Grazie. Grazie a lei. And that's the end of my time. But contrary to what Lorenzo has said, all the Italians I've spoken with here have excellent English, so I'm very glad that that you will not be relying on my Italian. However, if there are things that I say that you have trouble understanding, just raise your hand and ask me, and I'll try to explain it in other words or more slowly. This talk focuses on two particular works of literature or historical texts. They're texts by former African-American slaves in the United States in the 19th century. One is a work by a woman named Harriet Jacobs, and it's called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. The other is a famous work by Frederick Douglass, and it's called Narrative of My Bondage and My Freedom. These two texts that I'm going to be talking about are put in relation to contemporary queer theory, and in particular to contemporary anti-gay politics in the United States, Europe, and Russia. In her book, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, Harriet Jacobs writes under the name, the pseudonym, of Linda Brent. And she describes her book as an attempt to convince the people of the free states, those were the northern states in the United States where slavery was illegal, what slavery really is. So she was trying to explain to the northerners what slavery really consisted of. In order to do that, she repeatedly, throughout this book, turns to the image of a child, in particular a female child who is enslaved. Whether she's talking about the torment, the tortures of women in slavery who are denied the opportunity to have access to their own children, or whether she's depicting the terror of those children when they discover what it means to be a slave, which is to say when they discover that they are ripped away from their parents and particularly from their mothers and sold away from them into slavery to some other owner of them. Whether she's talking about one or the other, she repeatedly identifies the monstrosity that is slavery with violations of sexual and familial norms that have the effect of exposing children. And by this she means both the children of those who are enslaved, but also the children who are the children of the owners of the slaves. And parenthetically, let me add, often the two are the same, since the slave owner is often the father of the children who then become his slaves, as well as the father of children that he recognizes as his own. In either case, Jacobs describes slavery as producing, and these are her words, unclean influences everywhere around these children. Slavery, she characterizes as, and I quote, a cage of obscene birds. A cage of obscene birds. Slavery for her is bound up with obscenity. And this becomes for her a paradigm, an example of queerness as a sort of bad education. Now, she doesn't identify slavery by using the term queer, but everywhere she talks about slavery, she invokes it in terms of obscenity, in terms of sexual license, sexual freedom, and the dangers that this sexual freedom has insofar as it teaches children things they should not know. She writes that slavery is a pedagogy that leaves, and these are her words, a blight on children's souls. It blights them. It corrupts them. Displaying everywhere an eroticized economy of enjoyment. Slavery is an economy of enjoyment. Slavery is about taking pleasure in the ownership of someone else's body, in the power to manipulate that body, to make that body work for you. It thus becomes an overt, explicit economy of enjoyment. And it thereby produces, Jacobs argues, a general economy of transgression of the law, which is to say, because slavery is about the ownership of persons, it means that the laws that elsewhere regulate the relations among persons no longer obtain. The law is in abeyance here. And thus it gives an example for the culture at large of the possibility of generally turning persons into objects, no longer treating persons as persons, but making persons items through which enjoyment can be procured. Am I speaking too fast? Is everything okay? With that understanding then, we could say that for Harriet Jacobs, slavery opens a dangerous conceptual space within which the legal protection of persons becomes inseparable from the spectacle of persons transformed into objects of enjoyment and therefore placed outside the law's protection. Now, this could call to mind the state of exception and the condition that Giorgio Agamben associates with the figure of the homo sacer, the figure who undergoes abandonment by the law. But it produces more immediately for Harriet Jacobs a threat to the sovereignty of moral or natural law itself. Jacobs wants to defend what she identifies as natural or moral law, because natural law for her retains its full significance even when it is suspended by the laws of slavery. That is to say, she believes that there is a law above the law of slavery, and that it is that law to which society must return. And she makes this clear in a well-known passage from her autobiography, where she's talking about how persons under slavery are hungry and eager for the opportunity to find out what people in the North, in the free states, know about the truth concerning slavery. And in this passage, Harriet Jacobs writes the following: "One woman begged me to get a newspaper and read it over. She said her husband told her that the black people had sent word to the Queen of America that they were all slaves. That she, the black woman, didn't believe it. No, I'm sorry, she, the Queen of America, didn't believe the black people were all slaves in the South, and went to Washington to see the president about it. They, the Queen of America and the president, quarreled. She drew her sword upon him and swore that he should help her to make them, the black people, free." Harriet Jacobs then comments, "That poor, ignorant woman thought America was governed by a queen to whom the president was subordinate. I wish," Jacobs continues, "I wish the president was subordinate to Queen Justice," unquote. Lauren Berlant reads this passage in a book that she wrote recently and observes that Harriet Jacobs uses it to, quote, "show how dominated people find ways to sustain their hopefulness in a cruel world," unquote, and to demonstrate that, quote, "the kinds of invention, innovation, and improvisation her illiterate interlocutor practiced with only partial knowledge could be used radically for the reimagination of collective political life within the nation," unquote. To this, however, I want to add that this passage also serves as a figure for the sovereignty superior to written law that is offered as the only proper ground for the legitimacy of law itself. In that sense, the passage can indeed, as Berlant aptly puts it, be used radically, but radically in the sense of lacking a specific political content, in the sense, that is, of its availability to sustain antithetical ideological positions and socio-political beliefs. For this fantasy of an embodied justice whose ultimate sovereignty underwrites law does more than inspire the dominated to hopefulness through the, quote, "reimagination of collective political life," unquote. As Jacobs writes, while explaining her refusal after escaping to the North to even consider purchasing her freedom from the man in the South who still claimed her, she had escaped from slavery, was now living in the North, and she wrote to her owner, and he volunteered to free her if she would pay him the money that he could get by selling her as a slave. But she refuses to turn herself into an object of commerce and to buy her freedom, asserting that she is free by virtue of her personhood and need not pay for it. She writes, "I knew the law would decide that I was his property and would probably still give his daughter a claim to my children. But I regarded such laws as the regulations of robbers and who had no rights that I was bound to respect," unquote. Such opposition of a natural or moral law to the written law of the state establishes the basis for every form of antinomian practice and subtends usurpations of the law by the right and the left alike. Rebecca Hill, a political analyst, writes when talking about the political attack in the mid-19th century in America of John Brown, who was an abolitionist and working for the freedom of the slaves, and had a violent attack on a stronghold of slavery, claiming that he was justified by a higher law. Rebecca Hill writes of this, quote, "Scholars writing about John Brown in the 1970s connected his disturbing use of violence to the revolutionary left. Today's historians are just as likely to compare the antinomian Brown to the right-wing evangelical militants as represented by anti-abortion terrorists." In other words, antinomianism operates on extremes of the right and the left alike, and therefore antinomianism as such doesn't carry any particular political content. The conflict that elicits seemingly antithetical historical comparisons is at least as old as Sophocles' Antigone, in relation to which Jacques Lacan elaborates a reading of the law, the drive, and jouissance in the Ethics of Psychoanalysis. Now, Antigone's resistance to Creon's decree that her slain brother's body must remain unburied expresses, for Lacan, a tension between the authority of state law as wielded by Creon and the thonic law, the law of the earth, that Antigone associates with the unwritten law of gods, even older than Zeus. Lacan explains, quote, "These are no longer laws, nomos, but a certain legality, which is a consequence of the laws of the gods that are said to be agrapta, which is translated as unwritten. Unwritten, and he goes on, involved here is an invocation of something that is, in effect, of the order of the law, but which is not developed in any signifying chain," unquote. It's not developed in language, it's unwritten. This imperative that pertains to the order of the law, but that must always stay unwritten, unarticulated, and external to everything capable of representation in a signifying chain, pushes Antigone, in Lacan's reading, to inhabit what he calls the field of the other, the place beyond the limit of the human. If Lacan names what pushes beyond that limit as the death drive, as the reel of jouissance, then the limit of the human that she, Antigone, crosses is the limit of man-made law as it governs the representation of the collective good. Like the slave woman invoked by Jacobs, though, Antigone appeals to an authority, a truth, beyond the law of the state. And as the slave envisions the Queen of America drawing her sword on the nation's president, so Antigone does violence to Creon's law in the name of a law unwritten. We might say of the Queen of America, then, and of Jacob's investment in the natural law, whose higher authority the Queen of America figures, that the violence implicit in her unsheathed sword raises questions about her status, much like those Lacan raises about Antigone. Is Antigone, Lacan asks, as the classic interpretation would have it, quote, the servant of a sacred order, of respect for living matter? Is hers the image of charity? Perhaps, Lacan writes, but only if we confer on the word charity a savage dimension, unquote. It is this savage dimension of the drive, with its inseparability from jouissance, that makes the invocation of unwritten law so dangerous and so appealing. The division of the law between codified ordinance and the unwritten principles that ground it, with the latter permitting the fantasy that law is underwritten by justice, animates the political struggle that keeps the law open to revision, reversal, change. If it thereby offers the prospect of a reimagined collective existence, this division also exposes the queerness, the libidinal relation to an abjected enjoyment that undergirds law as such. In other words, the law itself is supported by a drive, a queerness that the law cannot recognize, something that remains unwritten in the law itself. Where the specificity of written law is concerned, this takes the form of the law's necessary positing of its own universal authority, while imposing the interests and protecting the enjoyments of particular persons, classes, or groups. And where the notion of the unwritten law is concerned, as the Queen of America and Antigone make clear, it takes the form of potential insurgents against the legitimacy of legal authority that enacts the enjoyment of transgression and the insistence of the drive from whose grip the law is supposed to protect us. Rebecca Hill's work on radical politics can help here, too, to clarify the stakes in this notion of a law beyond legislation. She writes, "This antinomian claim to access God's plan, also made by Nat Turner, a famous slave who had a rebellion in the South prior to the Civil War, is the principal claim to authority for people who are excluded from the process of lawmaking and legal participation in any society where religion plays a significant role in politics. While it is commonsensical that placing oneself above the law, particularly when justifying the use of force, can lead to terrible consequences, the labeling of such resistance as, by definition, anti-democratic carries its own risks. Those who level such charges as the antinomian heresy against anti-slavery activists of the 19th century should grapple with what it means to call for the rule of law in an era when slavery was officially legal. As such, attacks on John Brown's violence rest on the continuing erasure of the fact that slavery was a reign of terror," unquote. Now, my own point is neither to endorse nor condemn the appeal to a law beyond the law, but rather to note that its authority must be posited, must be imagined, must be imposed, just as the written law posits the authority of those who call it into being. It rests on the same initiating act of violence, that of positing as imposition, that enacts a particular mode of enjoyment while purporting to regulate enjoyment universally. This, of course, is Walter Benjamin's account of violence in the Critique of Violence, that law is always established through an initiating act of violence that is erased once the law as such comes into being as law, but that remains in place through the violence of the law's perpetuation. So the law perpetuates itself by enacting the legitimacy of violence to protect itself while erasing the fact that it only could come into being through an act of violence that was revolutionary and that violated the laws in force when it itself was established. By calling slavery a reign of terror, Rebecca Hill justifies the mimetic terror of John Brown's activities against it. But the historical referent for the reign of terror was not, of course, the institution of slavery, but precisely the Republican attempt to realize, amid the improvisational politics of revolutionary France, the absolutism of a law beyond law, come to earth with its sword unsheathed so as to usher in a new order. Slavery may be seen as a reign of terror, but so too then must the dispensation intended by the Queen of America. For each, slavery and the Queen of America, embodies a form of enjoyment that the other sets out to prohibit. And each, therefore, from the other's perspective, exemplifies bad education as the spectacle of brutalizing indulgence to which unbridled enjoyment gives rise. The Queen of America never, of course, raised her sword against the president because she doesn't exist. But Nat Turner raised his sword against slavery. And after his short-lived rebellion was quashed and hundreds of blacks across the South paid for that uprising with their lives, after that, the slaveholders in Harriet Jacobs' neighborhood came to the conclusion, as Harriet Jacobs writes, quote, It would be well to give the slaves enough of religious instruction to keep them from murdering their masters, unquote. Religion thus serves as a counterweight, an inoculation by alternative pedagogy to the seductive temptation to jouissance in the spectacle of open rebellion. But slavery itself, as Jacobs insists, enacts a spectacle of enjoyment against which she, like the anxious slaveholders in the face of Nat Turner's revolt, appeals to religion, to a fixed moral law, as a way to rally opposition to the pedagogy of enjoyment that slavery performs. For as Jacob's narrative repeatedly insists, slavery schools in vice everyone it touches. Raised, as Jacobs puts it, in, quote, an atmosphere of licentiousness and fear, unquote, the slave girl willy-nilly finds that, quote, the lash and the foul talk of her master and his sons are her teachers, unquote. The children raised as the master's own may learn to emulate his distinctively eroticized manifestations of mastery. But his slaves, who may carry the master's genes no less than the children he acknowledges, must learn to master their own resistance to his appropriation of their bodies and their wills. Jacobs recounts, she narrates, her own instruction in the sexual designs of the man who owned her, named Dr. Flint. Quote, he peopled my young mind with unclean images, such as only a vile monster could think of, unquote. And she decries the fact that for a slave girl like her, quote, there is no shadow of law to protect her from insult, from violence, or even from death, unquote. No shadow of law. To the contrary, the very law that places her in her master's hands gives license to his licentiousness. As property, she is his to enjoy and to cultivate for surplus value. Quote, this is a quotation from Jacobs again. Everywhere the years bring to all enough of sin and sorrow, but in slavery, the very dawn of life is darkened by these shadows, unquote. What she calls the shadow of law may fail to offer her any protection, but that shadow returns in the darkness of evils described as the shadows of sin and sorrow that do find shelter in law, and they thereby shadow the shadow of law with their own particular darkness. Engaged in a battle of wills with the master whose desire she spends the whole narrative working to thwart, Jacobs is also battling against the hegemony of national opinion that makes him her master by law. She must work to discredit the law and to solicit its protection at the same time. So she both wants the shadow of the law, and she wants to show us that the shadow of law is shadowed by sin. Her project must try to distinguish the shadow of law as shelter from the obscenity that shadows the law itself. And she does this by affirming a principle of reason capable of restraining the irrationality of particular laws in the name of a universal law that would be natural law or moral law in her view. And how better to image, to represent the darkness of vice that slave laws sanctioned than by showing its complicity in the moral corruption of the young? Quote, even the little child, Jacobs writes, who is accustomed to wait on her mistress and her children, will learn, before she is 12 years old, why it is that her mistress hates such and such a one among the slaves. Perhaps the child's own mother is among those particularly hated ones. She listens, the young child, to violent outbreaks of jealous passion and cannot help understanding the cause. She will become prematurely knowing in evil things, unquote. Of course, you understand that what the child is knowing is that the master's wife is jealous of such and such a slave, possibly including the child's own mother, because such and such a slave has become the mistress of the master. And therefore, the child is inculcated prematurely in evil things by learning that no woman is free of or safe from the sexual predations of the master. Later in Incidents, while talking about her own attempt to protect herself against the sexual advances of the master, she describes how she calculatedly, with clear sight and with clear intention, decided to take an older white man as her lover so as not to have to submit to her own master because she would already have been impregnated by another man. And she says, in her own self-defense, the influences of slavery had the same effect on me that they had on other girls. They made me prematurely knowing concerning the evil ways of the world. Unquote. So you see, this phrase recurs. It repeats itself. To become prematurely knowing. To know too soon. This idea of knowing too soon is what bad education entails. It means learning about sexuality. It means being educated in jouissance, in no longer being innocent of the knowledge of how sexual economies operate under slavery. Such knowledge enacts a violence made explicit by Jacobs when she talks about that knowledge compelling the child to realize that she is no longer a child. The child is deprived of, stripped of its innocence, and stripped of its childhood by being thrust into this cage of obscene birds. Taking this as her central figure for the injustices of slavery as an institution, Jacobs posits as universal the law's responsibility to children, and by extension, to the family that is the putative safeguard of childhood innocence. She uses this to ground her appeal for support against laws that tolerate the obscenities of slavery, whose obscenity finds its literal referent in premature sexual knowledge. But if innocence in this context entails freedom from the threat of an inappropriate knowledge, then the law whose sheltering shadow Jacobs aspires to gather around her would prohibit such contaminations by enforcing a liberal concept of privacy. In other words, if Jacobs is looking for the law to protect children against premature sexual knowledge, then what she aspires to is a liberal version of the law that is going to institute a division between obscenity, which is publication of private matters, and the private shadow of a private domain where sexual objects properly take place. By doing this, she participates in that liberal dispensation, which is going to eventuate in the differentiation between the possibility of a public discourse of sexuality and the insistence that sexuality must remain unspoken, must remain private. Thus, her attempt to free herself from slavery, in effect, would necessitate the enslavement of culture at large to a law of the obscene, where sexuality in public, any form of sexuality in public, becomes understood as obscenity. And only the shadow of a liberal privacy allows for sexual relations to take place. Is that something we can go on from? Good. privacy in which the sexual ought in this view to remain must not afford a sheltering shadow to improper, immoral, or illegal acts. The state, therefore, reserves the right to adjudicate the line between public and private, thus opening the private to the very publicity, the very politicization from which the state was invoked to protect it. In other words, once you have the state regulating the privacy of sexuality, there is no privacy for sexuality, since you're calling upon the state to enforce it. This pinpoints the difficulty that Jacobs confronts, not only in soliciting the shadow of law, but also in narrating her subjection to obscenities whose free circulation her text condemns as violating, quote, the most sacred commandment of nature, unquote. The South's peculiar institution, and that was the name for slavery, our peculiar institution. The South's peculiar institution is thus peculiar not only in its literal sense, which means distinctive or individuating, but also in the sense of unnatural, aberrant, perverse, or queer. It's an affront to natural law, and it contaminates with the taint of obscenity for Jacobs, not only her own blighted childhood, but also her very efforts to make known its obscene circulation of premature knowledge. This is the problem that Jacobs confronted in writing her book. When she set out to publish this book, she was publishing it mainly for women readers in the northern states in order to encourage their abolitionist fervor. But the narrative was a narrative of sexual violation. It was a narrative of rape. It was a narrative of seduction. It was a narrative of miscegenation. To that extent, to publish the book would be to publish sexual knowledge, and thus to produce the very obscenity that the book is arguing must be constrained. Therefore, when Jacobs goes to publish her book, she solicits the assistance of a white woman, Lydia Maria Child, who edits the book and writes an introduction. But in the introduction to the book, Lydia Maria Child has to explain to the white readers in the North that this book may seem offensive. It may seem to disturb the conventional sensibilities of womanhood because it is talking about obscenity. But it is insisting that this obscenity in public is the truth of slavery, and therefore one must be allowed to talk about the obscene in order to put an end to the obscenity. The irony here is that Harriet Jacobs herself becomes the black woman who threatens to taint the ears of white women with the same obscenity that she claims the white slave owners in the South are tainting the ears of black females with. So the circuit of bad education continues and moves from white slave owner in the South to black slave corrupting the North. Once Jacobs localizes the violence of slavery in sexualized knowledge that falls like a blight on children's souls, that blight, like the queerness from which it springs, attaches to all who come close to it. Now, suppose we were to place beside Jacob's reading of American slavery as public obscenity the terms in which Vladimir Putin has defended Russia's law against gay propaganda. The point would not be to equate the experience of sexual minorities in Russia with that of African Americans subjected to chattel slavery in the United States. It would be instead to gain some purchase on questions of sexuality, publicity, and law by seeing what Jacob's representation of slavery as a system of obscene education shares with the explicit justifications of Russia's disputed law. That law, as I'm sure all of you know, prohibits wherever minors could possibly encounter them any acts or representations that could, quote, arouse interest in, unquote, what the law portrays as, quote, non-traditional sexual orientations, unquote, or that might in any way suggest their social equivalence to heterosexuality. In the case of contemporary Russia, as in that of Jacobs, North Carolina, the shadow of law is called on to shelter those children whose freedom from corruption is threatened by the distribution of images or ideas held to violate the most sacred commandments of nature, and so to vitiate youthful purity. As Russia's constitutional court affirmed in its decision to sustain the law, this law was brought before Russia's constitutional court, and the constitutional court upheld the law. And it did so by saying, quote, "The government has a legal duty to take measures to protect children from information, propaganda, and campaigns that can harm their health and moral and spiritual development," unquote. By the way, I was just reading that apparently Italy is the only country in Europe with whom Russia still has treaties allowing for the adoption of children, because it's the only country in Europe where it is still completely illegal for homosexuals to have the possibility of adopting children. So perhaps as we're talking about Russia's law, we might think a little bit about places other than Russia as well. Access to certain sorts of knowledge, even knowledge of legal relationships, since homosexuality, as Vladimir Putin frequently reminds us, is not illegal in Russia. Access to information constitutes a form of bad education, a freedom that undermines freedom and destroys the foundation of civil society. Echoing American proponents of this Russian law, and there were several right-wing American groups that went to Russia to lobby on behalf of this homophobic law, echoing American proponents of the law, Vladimir Putin has suggested that, quote, "by protecting children from such information," information that is about the existence and about the existence of those identified as having non-traditional sexual orientations, "the law also protects society against a form of violence. And that violence, in Putin's terms, is designed to enslave society itself." He writes, quote, "It's about protecting us from rather aggressive behavior from some social groups who, in my opinion, are trying to impose their points of view in a rather aggressive way," unquote. If slavery for Jacobs was a queer obscenity, queerness for Putin is an obscene form of slavery. Before we get too comfortable, though, in our putative Western liberalism, recall that in France, a vociferous movement has gained support for boycotts of public schools in response to rumors that those schools are indoctrinating students in some version of gender theory that wants to make girls and boys identical by subjecting them to homosexual propaganda. Nor should we forget the continuing attempts in America where to introduce statewide legislation prohibiting elementary and middle school teachers from mentioning homosexuality in any context, even to prevent homophobic bullying. Like the infamous Section 28 of the Local Governments Act that was passed in Thatcherite Britain, both the Russian law and Jacob's focus on the child made prematurely knowing by the obscenities of slavery view the child as a site of endangered freedom while defending familial structures that treat children themselves as a form of property. Indeed, a decade and a half before Jacobs published Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, Karl Marx, in The German Ideology, wrote that, quote, "The nucleus, the first form of property, lies in the family, where wife and children are slaves of the husband. This latent slavery in the family," Marx writes, "though still very crude, is the first property," unquote. However critically he may view the structural domination that generates property, Marx nonetheless refers to it as, quote, "the natural division of labor existing in the family," unquote. where this allegedly natural organization of our earliest social relations arises from the fact that, according to Marx, it, quote, was originally nothing but the division of labor in the sexual act, unquote. Jacobs, like Marx, will implicitly naturalize the property rights of the family, so that for her, as for contemporary Russian law, and indeed for liberal thought in the West, the child, though deployed as a figure for freedom from enslavement to sexual corruption, has no symmetrical freedom to consent to encounter sexual knowledge. It has no claim to self-ownership, and so, like the slave, no freedom of will. Jacobs narrates an event from her childhood that encapsulates this tellingly. Her brother, Willie, was called upon to serve both his father and his legal owner at the same time, and didn't know which way to turn. He concluded, Jacobs writes, that he ought to give priority of response to the owner, the one who owns him, in the eyes of the law. Afterward, his father reproached him and said, "You are my child, and when I call you, you should come immediately if you have to pass through fire and water." What we see here is that the father, as owner, carries the same capacity to do violence to the child as the slave owner is owner. And therefore, the child is adduced, is offered to us as the figure of freedom who must be free from sexual corruption, the child was and remains quintessentially without freedom, and indeed is thus a fantasy figure of freedom, whose freedom is always subjected to the freedom of its parents to do with it what they will. Hence, constraints upon the freedom of the child never are actually concerns about the freedom of the child. Constraints on the freedom of the child are always fears about constraints on the freedom of their parents. Thus, the argument for keeping one's children from contact with anything that could strip them of their freedom from premature sexual knowledge stands not only for the enjoyment of freely exercising one's authority as a parent, but also for the enjoyment of a larger authority to be gained in the name of the child. The authority over others whose freedom might encroach in one's property rights in the child. In other words, parenthood is a form of property right, and the child becomes a property over whom one not only has the right to exercise one's authority, but in whose name one then exercises authority over others. Hence, the parent becomes the figure for the master of society, who holds society hostage to its own desire to create a society for its children that will be the society it wants to give to its children. But those children have no freedom to choose the society that they will live in, any more than the others who are subjected to the will of the parents to control the future in the name of their children are accorded the freedom to act as they want. Hence, the central force of Putin's law is to keep the children of parents from having to encounter the truth of the world, which is that not everyone is heterosexual, that there are, in fact, people of different sexual orientations, and that in Russia, it is perfectly legal to practice those sexual orientations. What it is not legal to do is to let children know about this. And it's not legal to let them know about this, because if they know about it, they might be corrupted by it, which is to say, they might be made prematurely knowing. Which is to say, the property rights of their parents to have a certain fantasy about the purity of their children will be put at risk. How then, given this, actually wait, I have to read something first. So here we have this situation where Russia is telling us that information cannot be transmitted publicly. Truths cannot be told publicly. The fact of non-traditional sexual orientations cannot be recognized publicly. How can a society that wishes to keep non-traditional sexual orientations legal nonetheless prohibit articulation of the fact of this very legality. There's a contradiction in terms here that the Russian Supreme Court, the Constitutional Court, encountered, and that the Russian news service encountered in reporting on this story. Because in order to tell about the story concerning the law against the discussion of homosexuality, Russian news media had to be able to discuss homosexuality. And therefore, the very reports about the law had to be prefaced with a warning that this news was not suitable for children under the age of 12. And the Constitutional Court in Russia, in trying to adjudicate the law that was being promulgated by the Duma, was faced with the difficulty of trying to deal with this. So, as the Russian Information Agency noted in a news article about the Russian law, whose subject required that it be labeled as unsuitable for those younger than 12, the Russian Constitutional Court decreed, and this is the decree of the Russian court, quote, "The exercise of civil rights and freedoms cannot be permitted at the cost of other people's rights," unquote. Now, I take it you understand the problem here. Rights cannot be permitted at the cost of rights. You cannot have rights or freedoms if they impinge on someone else's rights and freedoms. What's the problem here? That it's completely reversible. Everyone's rights and freedoms are going to impinge on someone else's rights and freedoms. So that the right to declare one's non-traditional sexual orientation in public may impinge on a heterosexual parent's right to keep its children from knowing that non-traditional sexual orientations exist, but the right of the heterosexual parent to keep its child from knowing that non-traditional heterosexual orientations exist will necessarily also impinge on the right of non-traditional sexual orientations to declare themselves in public. So the Russian Constitutional Court's declaration is essentially nonsense. It simply says that those in power can do what they want. This is a profound observation. It's Benjamin's observation about the queerness of the law. What the Russian Constitutional Court has recognized is first and foremost that the law is always queer. It is always about the enjoyment of particular classes being pursued at the expense of other classes. Of course, the Russian Constitutional Court would not recognize that it was saying anything of the sort, but its formula makes this very clear. So long as the state is positioned as the guardian of rights, construed as deriving from every subject's property right in himself, that self remains a property whose ownership the state alone adjudicates. And the freedom of the subject is thus delivered to constraint by the state in the name of freedom. How then should we all think about the fact that Frederick Douglass, also a slave, in his narrative, My Bondage and My Freedom, himself invokes a version of the Russian court's formulation in order to make the case for abolishing slavery? In his narrative, Frederick Douglass describes his master. His master was a man named Captain Anthony. And Captain Anthony was, according to Frederick Douglass, violent, crude, a man who was given to swearing foul oaths and to abusing the slaves horribly. But Douglass says Captain Anthony was not, for all of this, himself a monster. He says rather that he was simply a victim of his upbringing, of his education. And he writes, "Had he been brought up in a free state," meaning a northern state, "surrounded by the just restraints of free society, restraints which are necessary to the freedom of all its members, Captain Anthony might have been as humane a man as any who now oppose slavery." But here's the crucial point. For Douglass, who is aspiring to freedom, freedom is synonymous with restraint. Freedom means learning to constrain freedom. Freedom means learning to constrain enjoyment. it means learning to limit desire. In imagining Captain Anthony as Anthony might have been if he had been brought up in a free state, Douglas is suggesting that Captain Anthony himself is not free. He is bound by his own ideology, the ideology of the slave states, and thus he is a victim of slavery. He is enslaved. Having been raised in a slave state, Captain Anthony must live in a state of slavery himself, for as Douglas writes of slaveholders, and this is a quotation from Douglas's narrative, reason for slave owners is imprisoned here, and passions run wild. So for the slave owner, reason is imprisoned, and they are slaves to passion. The wildness of those passions is expressed in a scene where Douglas is whipping, witnesses the whipping of his aunt Esther. And if you've ever read the narrative of Frederick Douglass, it's a very violent scene where it's his first initiation into the complete freedom of the master to treat the slave as property. His aunt is bound at her hands. Her hands are lifted above her head by rope tied to the ceiling. Her clothes are stripped from her, and she is whipped repeatedly with a cowhide until welts open on her back and blood pours out. Douglas frames this moment, he represents this moment, in a way that reminds us, because of the language he uses, of an earlier moment in the text. It's a moment in the text where Douglas is talking about the freedom that as a slave child he experienced. Now there's an irony here. He's talking about himself as a slave child, and he's going to compare himself to the white children around him who are not slaves. Now you would think that the comparison would be the freedom of the white child and the oppression of the black child. But in this virtuoso passage, Douglas is going to reverse those terms for reasons that you'll see in a minute. So this is what he writes. The slave boy, like himself, seldom has to listen to lectures on propriety of behavior or on anything else. He is never chided for handling his knife and fork improperly, for he has none to use. He is never reprimanded for soiling the tablecloth, for he takes his meals on the floor. He is never expected to act like a nice little gentleman, for he is only a rude little slave. Thus, freed from all restraint, the slave boy can be, in his life and conduct, a genuine boy, doing whatever his boyish nature suggests, and acting by turns all the strange antics and freaks of horses, dogs, pigs, and barnyard fowl, without in any manner compromising his dignity or encouraging reproach. He literally runs wild. The slave boy is thus likened to Captain Anthony. Both of them run wild. They are not allowed the freedom that for Douglas comes with the inculcation of reason. Restraint equals freedom for Douglas, just as it did for Jacobs. But you can see that where sexuality is concerned, that's going to be problematic for all of the rest of us. As Douglas goes on to declare in the passage, if the slave boy can manage to keep out of the way of the other slave boys, he may trot on in his joyous and roguish tricks, as happy as any little heathen under the palm trees of Africa. He may continue to roll in the dust or play in the mud as best suits him, and in the veriest freedom, unquote. Freedom is here associated with Africa, but it's also associated with the animal. It's associated with the heathen. It's associated with what is not civilized. Douglas is internalizing the ideology of the Western master in order to associate true freedom with learning the ways of civilization and true civilization with restraining desire. Reinforcing the importance he places on the just restraints of free society, Douglas's slave boy, who literally runs wild, anticipates Douglas's depiction of the slave owner whose passions run wild by virtue of his enjoyment. Discussing what Thomas Jefferson called the boisterous passion of slavery as the unremitting despotism of the slave owners, Sadia Hartman claims that, quote, these boisterous passions bespeak the dynamics of enjoyment in a context in which joy and domination and use and violence could not be separated, unquote. Douglas and Lacan might allow us to add that the scene of enjoyment expresses not only the despotism of slave owners, but also their own enslavement by, their own unacknowledged subjection to, what Douglas describes as the passions, and Lacan would call the drive. Unlike Lacan, however, Douglas, like Jacobs, Putin, and the Russian Parliament, identifies the subject as such with reason, and his passions with what enslaves him, proposing, therefore, that freedom is always the proper restraint of enjoyment. If Douglas appropriates a faith in reason, he does so by claiming the very reason that Alain Badiou situates at the origin of Western philosophy itself. Badiou writes, the thesis according to which the libertine is unhappy, more unhappy than the wise man, is a foundational thesis of philosophy. It's Plato's thesis exactly. The evil person is unhappy. That's why, according to Socrates, philosophy works, because it's possible to tell people who have a choice between becoming tyrannical subjects of enjoyment or wise philosophers that the better choice is philosophy, unquote. But you recently translated Plato's Republic, where he reimagines Plato's text, the better to keep faith with its underlying energy. And here, he has Socrates give voice to a version of the thought that Frederick Douglass later will echo. Socrates identifies three agencies in the subject, thought, affect, and desire. And Badiou's Socrates maintains that in the ideal social order, quote, the rational agency will have to be dominant, unquote. Socrates then goes on to add, quote, thought and affect will keep an eye on desire. So that, obsessed as it is, as desire is, with repeatedly seeking immediate pleasures, it doesn't try to enslave the other two agencies and take power over the whole subject, unquote. If philosophy in the West from the beginning intends the subjugation of desire as enjoyment, as jouissance, as the constant repetition of the drive, it defends that subjugation in the name of the subject's freedom to seek the good, the idea, the truth, through thought or reason. Unlike enjoyment, which each of us encounters in radically particular ways, the idea, in Badiou's Platonic account of the philosophical tradition, pertains to everyone without distinction. And so, as Badiou puts it, must be universal. It must be free of any element that would prevent its being shared by all, unquote. But the idea as universal, like the idea of universality, can orient philosophy only by constraining the particularity of what Badiou's Socrates refers to as desire, what Lacan calls jouissance. If this constraint serves the purpose of freedom, defined as reason's domination of the subject, then the freedom offered as the alternative to the subject's enslavement to desire requires the enslavement of desire to reason, and hence the enslavement of those subjects made to figure desire, jouissance, and the pressure of the drive, to those subjects figurally positioned as the social bulwark against enjoyment as such. As we've seen, what's at issue here for Jacobs, for Douglas, for Putin, and for us is a battle between competing images of freedom that stand in for or take the place of competing figures of the subject. And those two figures of the subject might be defined as, on the one hand, the philosophical subject, the subject who embodies the abstract universality of thought in the symbolic, and, on the other hand, the psychoanalytic subject, defined by the specificity of a jouissance that binds it to the real. This might look like a specular structure, a mirror-like structure, one in which we see an absolute deadlock of positions that are symmetrical. But that neglects a crucial difference that ruptures the symmetry between them, a difference that can be seen by examining the case each one makes for its version of freedom. The first case for freedom, the case made by freedom as reason's necessary domination of desire, the philosophical case, can quickly be seen to bespeak a desire for the freedom that reason promises. It proposes, therefore, to constrain desire by instructing it, educating it, to desire the good. In doing so, however, it displaces, rather than subjugates, desire itself. Desire continues its domination through the mask of reason, merely representing as universal the particularity of its desire for the good. This universalization of the particular enjoyment to be had in the abstraction of reason from desire becomes the basis for refusing free expression to the particularities of jouissance, a refusal that undergirds slavery and the rhetoric of abolition both, and that generates the figure of queerness as the other of universality. Queerness is what is left out in every account of universality, as what universalism universally excludes. In his argument against the universalism he associates with Badiou, Etienne Balibar allows us to catch a glimpse of how such queerness falls out of the universal. This is a quotation from Balibar, quote, "The violent exclusion inherent in the institution or realization of the universal can take many different forms, which are not equivalent and do not call for the same politics. A sociological and anthropological point of view will insist on the fact that setting up civic universality against discriminations and modes of subjection in legal, educational, moral forms involves the definition of models of the human or norms of the social. Foucault and others have drawn our attention to the fact that the human excludes the non-human. The social excludes the asocial," unquote. Philosophy, for Badiou and Plato, in positing the universality of reason as the good, abjects the enjoyment that attaches it to universalism in the first place, an attachment that even philosophy recognizes as by no means universal. Douglas and Jacobs may appropriate philosophical versions of the life ruled by reason to cast slavery as a dangerous influence on those exposed to its obscenities. But philosophy in the West, from the very beginning, precisely as a form of enjoyment, has been attacked in the very same way. Indeed, for Badiou, the philosopher should merit the accusation brought against Socrates. For Badiou, the philosopher's duty is explicitly to corrupt the young. And she or he does so by promoting what the order that is, the order of opinions, the order of appearances. What the order that is must receive as a bad education. In other words, the goal of the philosopher is to promulgate a bad education, an education that runs counter to opinion, runs counter to the idea of truth, as understood within the given social order of society, thus to open the way for what Bajou would call an event. He therefore promotes what Bajou says, and this is a quotation from Bajou, is the irresponsibility of thought in the face of what is established. That's his idea of philosophy, the irresponsibility of thought. Or to put it more precisely, the responsibility of thought to be irresponsible, the responsibility of thought to evade conscription, circumscription, bondage to things as they are. The freedom of thought, in other words, to resist whatever law or transient opinion would constrain it. In cultivating this irresponsibility, this universal freedom of thought to conceive what the order of things makes unthinkable, philosophy, Bajou tells us, instills a singular responsibility. The singular responsibility to a universal practice that universally repudiates the domination of the subject by singular desires. Consider now the case to be made for freedom on the psychoanalytic side. Here, we have a subject capable of acknowledging and identifying with the particularity, the singularity of enjoyment. Though seeming symmetrical, this freedom entails no correlative fantasy of subjugating reason, precisely insofar as reason is recognized as an expression of jouissance. Thus, as the Slovenian critic Mladen Dolar rightly observes, quote, "The renunciation of enjoyment itself produces enjoyment. The very act of renouncing is always ambiguous, and there is never a subtraction of enjoyment that wouldn't be at the same time an addition in the very same gesture. Fighting the enjoyment, advocating a suppression of the enjoyment, always turns into a remodeling of enjoyment, offering new ways of enjoyment rather than getting rid of enjoyment. Indeed, enjoyment appears as the one thing that can never be gotten rid of," unquote. In this context, we can better understand why Russia's constitutional court produced such nonsense in decreeing that the exercise of civil rights and freedoms could not be permitted at the cost of other people's rights. Precisely insofar as enjoyment is particular, and the restraint of a mode of enjoyment for some will generate enjoyment for others, the subject's freedom of enjoyment invariably opens onto conflict. By refusing our dominant view of law as protection against potential harm, the freedom of enjoyment, as Lacan makes clear, invokes a Sadean universe, governed by Sade's still disquieting version of the Kantian categorical imperative. And this is this is Lacan's version of Sade. "Let us take as the law, as the universal maxim of our action, the right to enjoy anyone at all as an instrument of our pleasure," unquote. Here we return with a vengeance to Jacob's cage of obscene birds, to Douglas's image of passion's world running wild, to Putin's fears that information about non-traditional sexualities is itself an assault, an aggression. In response to the sort of repugnance the Sadean universe arouses, Lacan makes the following claim, quote, "If the same opening is given to all, one will be able to see what a natural society looks like. Our repugnance may be legitimately related to that which Kant himself claims to eliminate from the criteria for moral law, namely, to the realm of sentiment," unquote. In other words, if you recoil from the Sadean universe, it is a mere sentimentality you are enacting, because the Sadean universe for Lacan is simply the psychoanalytic universe itself. Hortense Spillers, describing Harriet Jacobs, complains that Jacobs was not allowed to claim her body as her own, that ethics must follow from the notion that our bodies are our own, and that that ethics is an ethics of freedom. But resisting this version of the Western liberal consensus, Guy Ockenham, offering an account of queer theory avant la lettre, envisioned an alternative in 1974 in a series of essays published in L'Après-midi des Fonds. There he claimed that, quote, in describing sex as the property of the free and conscious person, one perpetuates the old deception. Our bodies belong to us. What sadness that the body of each belongs to all who wants to enjoy it would make a much more satisfying formulation, unquote. Perhaps a more satisfying formulation, but not necessarily a more pleasurable experience. For enjoyment exceeds the pleasure principle, and in doing so exposes the gap on which every version of freedom founders. The gap of the subject's division between pleasure and enjoyment, between desire and drive. Lacan quotes Kant on the moral law in order to explain the consequences of the movement toward the only sort of act that he thinks bespeaks freedom. Quote, we can see a priori that the moral law as the determining principle of will, by reason of the fact that it sets itself against our inclination, must produce a feeling that one could call pain, unquote. Lacan then expands on this idea and makes clear that to open the floodgates of desire is to open onto a horizon of pain. The other's pain, as well as our own pain. To the degree that this informs sexuality, it informs as well an experience of the death drive, a drive that is constantly moving us toward a pleasure that is unbearable to us. Unbearable to us. Unbearable to the subjects as which we know ourselves. If radical enjoyment propels us towards something that stands in for Lacan, for the real, for the death drive, for an enjoyment beyond, for what never gets articulated in any signifying chain, for what is an unwritten law, then this enjoyment that discovers the unbearable in the extremity of our pleasures expresses the absolute of freedom. Where freedom is separated from sentiment, and yet it also expresses the absolute of compulsion, where we become no more than the playthings of the drive. Bad education invariably leads us to this insurmountable impasse of freedom, where we encounter the violence of positing from which the shadow of every law emerges. The positing, the imposition of a subject of freedom with which our desire would coincide. But the Lacanian act, which negates the subject of fantasy and so negates the subject of desire, offers us, as a critic named Ed Pluth has written, quote, a way of thinking about manifestations of freedom without the usual presupposition of a sovereign, conscious subject exercising that freedom, unquote. It thus takes us beyond the imaginary realm, where freedom is mapped onto our comfort zone of mutuality and consent, of universally recognized human rights, of protection from discrimination or harm. It opens onto the nightmare world of enjoyment as queer negativity. We can never own or own up to such queerness any more than we can escape it. Avowing it would misrepresent it as a prescription for the good. But if queerness is to remain an active concern, an ongoing challenge to social norms, and not just a name for the liberal project of gay normalization, then we have to confront the abyss of enjoyment, from which queerness, like the will to restrain queerness, springs. The abyss of enjoyment that enslaves us to the lethal dream of being free. Lethal because it is also the dream of being free from queerness. Thank you.
indeed. Thank you, Lee, for this, we make it pausing by 3 minutes, I think. I just wanted to thank you for this intense and thrilling and generous talk, that, as you say, perfectly fits our situation in Italy, not only for this relationship about adoption between Russia and Italy, but for several reasons. Because in Italy and in Verona, every discourse aiming at promoting LGBT rights is accused of being a form of bad education and of corruption of the youth. I just want to make some examples before our break. For example, I personally was accused from Catholic integralist movements of being a professor or frocismo militante, as I said to you before. I'm proud of it. Militant fagotism. And in general, Italian university is also not so open to feminist and queer studies. Most scholars in these subjects were in fact penalized at the last national qualifying examination for the title of associate professor and full professor in Italy. In addition to that, last March, the educational campaign against sexual minorities discrimination proposed by the National Office Against Racial Discrimination was opposed and blocked not only by a Catholic Church, but recently also by Stefania Giannini, that is the new Minister of Education in the new government led by Matteo Renzi. It should be the left government. And another example, tomorrow here in Verona, in the prestigious Palazzo della Gran Guardia, just in front of the arena, a representative of the Patriarchy of Moscow called Alexei Komov will speak in defense of the natural feminine, that is, of course, against abortion, against women's self-determination, against contraceptions, against gay and lesbian marriage, and against anti-discrimination campaigns. And this conference will have the patronage of our major here in Verona. In this situation, I think we really need bad teachers. We need a bad education and bad teachers, as you maybe are. And so I'm really happy that you are here as a bad teacher. I have several questions, but I hope you also have some questions, but I think we need a break now, maybe to someone has to smoke a cigarette, drink something, go to the toilet, and then we will be back here in 15 minutes, I think. Thank you. So I have some books here if you want to have a look. Libri del professor Edelman, e anche l'unico libro che per ora in italiano ha tradotto un estratto dal saggio No Future, che è Canone Inverso, curato da Elisa Arfini, che è qua insieme a Cristian Lo Iacono. Se volete sfogliarli, dare uno sguardo.
Sorry.